just staying with the same like mental routine for every single pitch, one pitch at a time. This pitch right here, full focus, full execution to the straight through the target. And you know, it was definitely harder in the ninth inning than the other ones, but we stayed with it. I kind of screwed up that last one, but Engie bailed me out in right field big time.
Lucas Giolotto, he is the owner of a no-hitter for the Chicago White Sox last night. They shut out the Pirates 4-0. It's the 304th no-hitter in Major League Baseball history. The last one, September 1st, by Astros ace Justin Verlander. There were four no-hitters last season. Of course, probably not as many this year with just 60-game schedule. He had 13 strikeouts, did Giolotto 30 swing and miss strikes. He was on his game, and he gets the no-no last night. For the White Sox, having a pretty good year so far, and the Royals are going to see the White Sox here very soon. Welcome to the Sports Ticket. Wade and Dusty with you. Speaking of the Royals get a W last night, and Ryan O'Hearn with a home run to tie it up.
And now Ryan O'Hearn belts it into deep right center field. That is base hit number 3 tonight, and this one is a home run. And he is finally on the board with his first of the year.
That tied it, and then Ryan McBroom came through with a two-out ground ball single in the left field, scoring Hunter Dozier in the eighth inning and giving the Royals a 5-4 lead. They go on to win it. Former Cardinals closer Trevor Rosenthal, it'd be sweet for him. And, of course, Mike Matheny, former manager of the Cardinals. Rosenthal worked out of a jam in the ninth, picked up a 7th save in the win. Got a big strikeout at Tommy Edman with runners on first and third with one out, and then he got Paul Goldschmidt to ground out to end the ball game. And the bullpen did its job. Scott Barlow got out of a jam thanks to a great relay. Whit Merrifield all the way to Mondesi to Cam Gallagher to nail Paul DeJong, who's trying to score the tying run. That was a big play there in the eighth inning. And so Mondesi struggling at the plate, but it is not affecting his defense, and that is good to see. And remember, he's just 25. It might just take him a little bit of time. Dozier took a while before he started to click, of course. Came into his own last year with 28 homers and 84 RBIs. Everybody progresses at different rates. And Mike Matheny, pretty happy with his bullpen last night.
What a great job from the pen all together when you're looking at coming in with Newberry in a tough situation. Pitching out of it. Ian did a great job. I thought Jesse Hahn threw the ball really well. And obviously, when you bring it over and hand it off to Stamon Barlow and Rosie, and that was a great effort for that bullpen to pick us up.
You look at the bullpen last night. You know, Matt Harvey did not pitch well, and I wasn't really sold on them grabbing him, but you know, he can try. Maybe he'll figure something out. 2 2/3, 5 hits, 4 runs. Jake Newberry inning in a third scoreless, couple of walks. Jesse Hahn inning scoreless. Ian Kennedy inning scoreless. Josh Domont gets the win. His ERA is 0.73. 2 strikeouts, an inning of work, couple of walks. Scott Barlow's been really, really good. ERA 1.59. He got a hold last night. Allowed a couple hits. Worked out of that jam thanks to that relay from Witt to Mondesi to Gallagher. And then Rosenthal, of course, has been lights out for the most part this year, although a few jams recently. His ERA is 1.46, and he could be one of those guys the Royals trade. He's from Kansas City. He'd love to stay in Kansas City. He said that last night after the game. We'll see if the Royals trade him or if they try to sign him. He's 30 years of age, and Scott Boras is his agent. I'm not feeling too great about it, although if Rosenthal really wants to be a Royal, then he can say to his agent, I want to be a Royal.
Mm-hmm.
Royals now 12-18, Cardinals are 10-9. Of course, they are way behind because of missing almost 3 weeks of the season due to COVID-19. So the Royals will finish up their series against the Cardinals tonight, 7-15. Jacob Junis off the injured list will pitch for the Royals against Hudson for St. Louis. So the Royals need to get on a winning streak here pretty quickly to have a chance at perhaps making that expanded playoff field, which, of course, now is 16. All right, coming up on the Sports Ticket, college football, some cases at Texas Tech with the football team, also the University of Alabama, a report on all the cases that they have. We'll discuss the effects that could have on the SEC and the Big 12 in their hopeful upcoming football season. And a Chiefs player receives his suspension, the NBA NHL playoffs, some exciting stuff last night on both the ice and on the basketball court. But first, this week we are being joined by a coach each day to talk about fall sports. Monday it was Brad Gobert, head coach of the Bullet Trojan football team. Yesterday, Steve Tiernan, head coach of the defending state champion Osborne Bulldog football squad. Today, Jason Carr, unique situation at St. John's Tipton with their volleyball team as they have not one head coach, but two co-coaches. head coaches.
Yeah, Stacy Perez is helping out this year with Jason, and they're working on things together. Jason says, I took the radio part of it.
I was going to say, did Stacy draw out the big straw, and Jason drew out the small, short straw, and that's why I do the radio bit?
Yeah.
Is that how that worked? They did rock, paper, scissors?
Yeah, they might have had a real hard fight, too.
I don't know.
Probably
I would
not.
Yeah. Apparently, Jason lost. Yeah. Stacy beat up Jason.
I think Jason just kind of gave in. Okay, I'll do it.
I like it.
Jason, I know Jason really well, though, so it's easy to talk to guys you know really well. So, but yeah, they're working hard in practices, and he's been the assistant with Marcy Key the last 3 years there, so he knows all about the program and what's going on there. So yeah, they're working hard there at St. John's Tipton, getting ready for the season opener on Friday against Osborne.
All right, here's Jason Carr, co-head coach, St. John's Tipton Volleyball. Join us on the ticket.
Welcome back here on the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com. We're joined now by Jason Carr. He's one of the new co-head coaches for the St. John's Tipton volleyball team and getting set for the season opener coming up later this week. Coach, first of all, thanks for taking some time to join us. Jason, you were assistant coach with Coach Key there for a few years, and now you and Stacy Perez have taken over as the co-head coaches for the volleyball team. What's the transition been like from that aspect of going from assistant to head coach and working with Stacy as well?
Well, it hasn't been too bad at all. The girls, you know, a lot of these girls I've been with for 3-4 years now, so we kind of know what to expect, and the girls are really good together, so nothing has really changed that much. Mrs. Key had set this up and has done a really good job with everybody, and it's worked in the past year, so we really haven't changed a whole lot with it. We kind of keep the same things in place and keep the girls moving, and it seems to work well. So thanks to Mrs. Key for doing a lot of that in the past years.
You did lose quite a bit of talent from your team last year that went 30-9. One that really stands out is Caitlin Strong, who was your setter for however many years. I think she was a 3-year starter at the setter position for you. But you did have like Tara Ellens and some of those, Emily Kenigsman, Lydia Eilert played a lot for you as a libero throughout her career. So you do lose some players. What's been the biggest challenge of trying to fill those voids that you lose there?
I think it's always a challenge when you have somebody that, you know, plays for a few years in the starting position, and then you have to replace it. The girls this year, everybody has stepped up, and, you know, they're willing to fill that role, and they're willing to work at it. So I have a really, really great group of girls, and, you know, there's a lot of consistency there and some girls stepping up to hit the ball and set the ball and everything for us. So I don't have you know, we're not really trying to fill gaps, as we already have the girls in place to do that, so it helps out this year.
We look, you do have your top hitter back in Lauren Dubert, and I'm guessing that you're going to rely on her quite a bit to help lead this team as a senior now. It's hard to believe she's already a senior there, but Ella Wiles had a good season for you as a freshman last year. She's back as a sophomore. How much do you rely on those hitters that you're going to see that do have some experience for you?
Oh, we got to rely on them on every single match. I think, you know, Lauren being the senior, she is good, and she's done a lot for the team, and she's going to keep doing a lot for the team. You know, Ella being a freshman last year, there's a lot of things that she needed to work on. And, you know, at the start of practice this year, she was doing really good, and she continues to improve on it. So we have a couple other girls in there, too, with Leah and Paige. You know, they can both get up and do the same thing. So we have a really good, great group of girls.
I'm not trying to make you give away any secrets or anything here, but do you have a new setter that you're working with, or is it going to be kind of a platoon situation, or what's the deal on that without Caitlin now this year?
Well, without Caitlin, you know, we'll work with Paige has always been the setter in the past coming up, and she has done a really good job this year. So, and we've worked with a few other girls. We have some plans in mind that if, you know, if we start struggling or whatnot, we can do some other things too. So those are all the things we've been working on in practice.
and co-head coach there at St. John's Tipton Volleyball, Jason Carr, with us here on the Sports Ticket. As you move into the head coaching role, like I said, you've been an assistant the past 3 years, and you and Stacy are doing something a little different this year that a lot of people don't have to deal with their first year of coaching, and that's the COVID-19 situation and all the, you know, some of the new restrictions that you have and some of the new protocols that are in place. What are some of those, and how have you been able to deal with those here in the first few practices in the first week and a half or so?
Now, the first few, they haven't been terrible. We just have to check their temperatures before they come in. They have to wear a mask when they come in. Once we get started and we get separate, then we don't have to wear a mask anymore in the gym there. But once we get together as a group again, we have to put our masks on. Moving forward, it's unfortunate. You know, a lot of things have to change as far as the games go, with the girls not being able to come together on a dead ball. Coming off the court, they have to put a mask on, and not having as many fans at games either. So, you know, there's going to be quite a few changes there that we're all going to have to go through with the COVID-19.
Has it been challenging as far as getting everybody to agree to that, or is everybody just kind of like, okay, if we want to play, we just got to roll with the flow?
That's exactly. I think everybody just feels that they want to play and they want to get it in. So they're going to follow whatever we can in order to make sure that we keep playing and keep everybody safe.
Osborne coming up on Friday. You'll open out the season over there. And the Lady Bulldogs obviously made some improvements as the seasons have gone on here over the past few. What do you expect to see there when you go out, just from your team, and what are your hopes for Friday?
I think we're going to come out pretty strong. The girls have been working really hard on making sure that we can hit just about everything that comes out. From the setter, over the net, whatever we can do. So the girls have been working hard on that. And, of course, Osborne in the past years, I think they had a new coach a couple of years ago. She's done really well with those girls, and they hit everything over the net. So we have to be ready. Diggers, everybody in the back row has to be ready to get that stuff so we can get some good hits on the net.
Jason Carr, the new co-head coach with Stacy Perez there of the St. John's Tipton volleyball team. We certainly thank you for joining us, and I hope everything goes well for you on Friday and as you get through, and hopefully we can get this season in, Coach.
Thank you, Dusty.
Jason Carr, St. John's Tipton co-head volleyball coach. That's an interesting dynamic because, you know, I've coached baseball teams before where really myself and the other coach are, in essence, co-head coaches. Mm-hmm. We always talk about everything, but eventually, though, somebody has to make a decision in regards to, are we going to try to steal second in the situation with two outs? You know, are we going to pitch this guy? Eventually somebody, you both can go back and forth, say, I mean, if you both agree on it, fine, but somebody still has got to tell the catcher, all right, four fingers, intentional ball out here, all right, intentional walk, or whatever the case may be. So that is interesting when you have, because what you have is a chain of command. When you have a head coach and an assistant coach, you know how that works.
Yes.
With co-head coaches, that's going to be an interesting dynamic. And the only way it can possibly work is if both highly respect one another and talk to each other, but they both got to know between Coach Perez and Coach Carr that somebody's going to have to, at some point in time, have to make that decision. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I have no doubt that Jason and Stacy will get along and be able to do that. Yeah. And that's why they can do it. You know, they know each other well. And Stacy's worked with them girls in junior high too. And I think it just all works out pretty well for them. But it is a different dynamic for sure. Mm-hmm. I think there was one other time that St. John's volleyball did that. I know Jerry Bates was one of the co-head coaches. And I don't remember if it was maybe when Rachel Avery was there too. I don't want to quote myself on that. Sure. But they've done it in the past before there. And it seemed to work out that time, so we'll see if we keep going in that direction. And it is a different dynamic, and hopefully it works out for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So we appreciate Jason. Brandy Paul, the head coach of the Beloit volleyball team, expected to be our guest coming up tomorrow on the Sports Ticket, and then we'll try to have somebody on Friday, and we'll just keep rolling as we go into next week, and hopefully that's what we can do, keep on rolling. Yes. Right into the sports season. There's some sports stuff this weekend, right?
Yeah.
Actually, tomorrow, isn't it?
Tomorrow, Sacred Heart plays tennis tomorrow, okay. I think. Uh-huh. And then most like Beloit and Osborne tennis will open up next Tuesday, I believe.
Okay.
But then volleyball, yeah, Friday for St. John's and Osborne. St. John's, Tipton, and Osborne will open up the volleyball season Friday. So
this Friday?
Yeah, this Friday.
Yeah, yep. Wow. Yeah, and I know Beloit doesn't start till next week.
Yeah.
Volleyball next Thursday, if I remember correctly. And in high school football next Friday.
Yes.
We hope all this works out.
It's looking good right now. Let's keep our
fingers
crossed.
Knock on the wood, baby. Knock on the wood. Cross your fingers and toes. All right, let's shift to college here, where Texas Tech has reported 21 active cases of COVID-19 within its football program. However, per the university, it will not pause practices while those who have been infected are placed in isolation to stop the spread of the coronavirus. To date, Texas Tech has not had to suspend practices or other athletic-related activity due to the coronavirus pandemic. In all, Texas Tech has completed 1,382 tests to its athletes, coaches, and staff since campus was reopened in June. And during that time, the university has recorded 64 positives, including the 21 within the football program. That's a positive rate of about 4.6%, just under the 5% threshold recommended by the World Health Organization for reopening. Generally speaking, lower positive rates can indicate that there is sufficient testing being done. Texas Tech has been testing every member of the football program weekly since late July. And the first game for Texas Tech is a little less than 3 weeks away against Houston Baptist, September the 12th. Now, the following weekend is open, so if they need to reschedule, perhaps they could do that a week later if they need the extra time. Conference Commissioner Bob Oldsby has said he expects disruptions due to the coronavirus this fall as the Big 12, ACC, and SEC, and three other FBS conferences attempt to play football. The American Athletic Conference, the AAC, which is what Wichita State's a part of, interesting decision they made yesterday that all their fall sports are going to be moving to the spring, but football is going to stay in the fall. And before you get critical, because immediately my first thought was that's weird, but then when you really think it through, it makes sense. First of all, they almost have to move all those other sports to the spring because that's what's happening with the NCAA for the most part with all the other sports. And then football, that's really up to you what you can do. If you have a schedule and your league is going to basically play, you know, each other, like the Big 12 and the SEC, ACC are going to do, except with the exception of one non-con game to start it off, then they can still do that. So kind of interesting how that's working in the AAC. So Big 12 spokesman Bob Burda says the conference, the Big 12, is still working on COVID-19 policy for a standard that would force game postponement. He said Big 12 plans to have one in place prior to September 12th non-conference football games. And I think that's the question I'm asking, and I think many other people are asking, is when is there too many cases? Like Texas Tech, 21 active cases within its football program. We don't know the breakdown as to players, staff members, trainers, who knows. What is the? Is it a percentage of tests that test positive that prevents you from playing a game? Is it the number of players? Of course, if you had a group of players, like say your offensive line all gets it, now you're in trouble, you're probably not going to play, even though you might only have 1% positive rate on your test, but if it's the wrong group of people. So it'll be really interesting moving forward how that's all handled by the conference and all the individual conferences. We know the NCAA doesn't have any power. Alabama, 6 days after classes began, the University of Alabama has experienced an unacceptable rise in coronavirus cases. The university's president said University of Alabama's main campus in Tuscaloosa has recorded 531 total cases. The remaining campuses in Birmingham and Huntsville have recorded 35 cases altogether. Here's the thing, though. You got to keep this in mind. This is why people start to freak out. I've been talking to people about this lately. 531 positive cases sound like a lot, and that is a lot. There were over 46,000 tests, and 566 were positive, which means the positive rate was 1.2%. So only 1% or 1.2% of all of those tested were positive. So if you present it as, oh my gosh, Alabama has 531 positive cases, it sounds really daunting, doesn't it?
It does.
But then when you say that there were over 45,500 that were negative and that only 1.2% of the 46,000 cases were positive, that doesn't sound so bad at all, does it?
No.
It's amazing how quickly we can shift the numbers to fit our agendas. Amazing how that works. Like we talked about yesterday, the NFL conducted 58,000 COVID tests last week. Only 6 out of 58,000 were positive. But if a writer has an agenda or a media member has an agenda, and they just want clickbait, you know what they'll put at the top of the story? They're not going to put only 6 cases of COVID-19 in the NFL. They won't put 57,994 players tested negative, 6 positive. They will put the NFL has 6 positive NFL COVID cases. And people won't read the story to see the rest of the numbers. They'll read the headline. They'll go telling everybody at the water cooler, man, NFL's got a problem, man. Do you see that? 6 players got COVID. That ain't going to be good. It's just the way the world works nowadays. Yeah. University of Alabama President Stuart R. Bell called on all students, faculty, and staff to work together at this critical moment after the climb in COVID-19 cases on campus. Bell urged social distancing, mask wearing, and limited gatherings. He said violators would be subject to possible suspension from school. Completing a fall semester together is our goal. Bell said Sunday in an email to students, the margin for error is shrinking. I didn't catch the whole thing at the top of the hour in the news. Maybe you did, Dusty. But something about they're not going to test asymptomatic, you know, they aren't showing symptoms. Mm-hmm. They're going to test. See, here's the thing. If you test all students, but they have no symptoms, and, I mean, you're going to get positive tests. You're going to.
Yeah.
Now, if you have more testing, you're going to have more positive cases. You're also going to have more negative cases, but doesn't get reported.
Yes.
And the other thing we talked about before is we need to know what are active cases. You know, what are active cases? And so, and I know COVID is different than the flu, but there are a lot of similarities. And, you know, how many times over the years have we haven't done any testing, and how many people maybe had a symptom of the flu, but it wasn't too severe, you know?
Yeah.
Or they got the chills, but then they were good. You know, it was a one-day thing. And did they spread that to 15 people in school? We don't know for sure. Maybe, maybe not. Have no idea. You know, you're kind of getting to the point when you think about it. We're kind of getting to the point where you wonder if you just move forward on college campuses and you can't test every single student. You do wonder sometimes if you just maybe you don't worry about testing every single student or all these students. It's just that you get tested when you think you have symptoms, mm-hmm. that you show symptoms. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's. I think that's what it is for me. I mean, I don't know. You talk about, you know, it's not like the flu and you know, there's different things you got to do. But I'm getting, you're talking to getting to the point. Like, you kind of get to the point. I get to the point where I realize that, yeah, you don't want the kids going to school and having it and passing it along to the older group that might be more affected by it. But the flu is worse.
Yeah.
For the kids that are in the school, like their age, it affects them worse as far as the symptoms and what could actually end up being the end-all, be-all. There's going to be more deaths from the flu in that age of
people.
Mm-hmm. People than mm-hmm. there is.
Right.
So it's
but what about the professors? You know, they're 55 years old
exactly,
or whatever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Professors at colleges. So you're trying to balance and trying to understand, you know, there's still other people at the school. It's not just the kids. So that's where, you know, that you're wrestling with what's right on that part of it. But yeah, I mean, if you're testing, not testing asymptomatic or symptomatic people, whatever you're doing, I think a lot of that's going to come down to test availability too. And, you know, wanting to know let's just not test them. They don't have any symptoms. We'll just move on with life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Probably going to get more confusing as we get into the winter months, but we shall see. We're going to take a 60-second timeout. We're still on Z96.3 The Lake. I don't know if we're off on 94.1. We'll double-check that, and we'll be back with you. The Chiefs have another player that's being suspended on the defensive side of the ball. We'll tell you who. NBA playoffs roll on. We're here from Paul George, who had a big game last night. And NHL playoffs, pretty exciting game that went to overtime.
Mahomes moving to his left laterally, chased, and gets up the sideline. He's not out of bounds yet. Inside the 10, he dives for the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City. Maybe the best play yet of Patrick Mahomes' young career.
For the past 7 years, Z96.3 Through the Lake has been your home in north central Kansas for Kansas City Chiefs football.
Damian Williams trying to get to the edge, breaks a tackle, 35, 30. Damian Williams, 20, stays in bounds, 15, 10, 5.
excited to announce that for the next five seasons, Z96 Point Through the Lake will still be the home for Chiefs Kingdom.
The Chiefs Kingdom has firmly planted its flag on top of football's highest summit. The Kansas City Chiefs are champions of Super Bowl 54.
In 2020 and beyond, Z96 Point Through the Lake, your home for the Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs in North Central Kansas.
And the Super Bowl Chiefs are going to be short, as we know, Bashaun Breeland for a four-game suspension. And now Mike Pinnell, who we knew nothing about this until Steve Spagnuolo let the cat out of the bag last week at a press conference. Mike Pinnell has been suspended for the first two games of the 2020 season. And Mike Pinnell, you might not really know him that well, but if you're a Chiefs fan, you know he helped against the run. When they picked him up, undrafted free agent, partway through the season last year, and they re-signed him to a new deal in the offseason. And the news is official, although the league didn't give any reason for the defensive tackle suspension either. The Topeka native did respond Tuesday on Twitter, Mike Pinnell, and he said, "First and foremost, I want to apologize to my family, friends, teammates, coaches, the Chiefs organization, all of Chiefs Kingdom. Although I am completely unaware of how this occurred, I take full responsibility for what goes into my body and promise to be more vigilant moving forward. I am truly sorry and ask for your grace and forgiveness. I promise to return with a vengeance in our journey to run it back." The 29-year-old played in 8 games last year with the Chiefs, 24 tackles in 1 sack. He was suspended twice in 2016 when he played with the Packers for violating the league's substance abuse policy. And, of course, as we mentioned, due to off-the-field issues, Bashaun Breeland is out for the first 4 games of the season. So the Chiefs will be down a couple defensive players for the first 2 games, and Pinnell will come back in week 3. So the Chiefs hurt by suspensions on the defensive side of the ball. They'll be able to cope, I think, with both losses. I think the Breeland one is a bigger one of the two in regards to losing a guy's suspension. But Pinnell was a nice addition to help against the run. The Chiefs' running game, a run defense, got better about when he came into the fray, to be quite honest with you.
Yep.
Okay, the NBA playoffs last night. Dusty was right. The Nuggets, he said, were going to win and stay alive. I looked pretty smart for about 3 full quarters. Jazz were up 15 points, and I thought it was over. I really did. But Jamal Murray, you know, we talked so much about Donovan Mitchell recently and what he's done. And also you look at what Doncic has done, and Lillard, and Kawhi Leonard, and Giannis, and all these guys. And Jamal Murray, he just continues to light it up. He had, 33 of his 42 points in the second half, and he was just a one-man show. And towards the end there, yesterday against the Jazz, it was everybody clear out, it's a 1-4 set, and I'm taking whoever's guarding me, and I'm scoring. And Jamal Murray did it over and over yesterday.
Murray's coming for more. 50 in game 4, 40 tonight. Murray again. The mesmerizing talent of Jamal Murray. 9-point Denver lead.
Jamal Murray, 42, 33 in the second half, 8 rebounds, 8 assists, no turnovers, and he's their point guard. Nuggets beat the Jazz 117-107. Jazz still lead that best of 7, 3-2. Also last night, well, we both said the Clippers were going to win. We did get that one right. Dusty was 2-for-2 last night in his predictions. Well done.
Lucky guesses.
Clippers.
Well, one was lucky. I was pretty confident in the Clippers.
50-50 shot. Yeah. I was too. Didn't expect the Clippers put up 154, though. 154-111. That was the final. Paul George, 35. Kawhi Leonard, 32. We were just discussing this yesterday, that the Clippers are not going to win the title if Paul George doesn't play better. If Paul George plays like he did yesterday, then I look smart saying the Clippers are going to win this whole thing, like I said before day one, before in training camp, and before the playoffs. But like I said, I was wavering a little bit because if Paul George doesn't step it up, the Clippers are not going to win at all. And in fact, they could even lose this series to the Mavericks. George stepped up. Doncic looked tired, and of course, he's still banged up with that ankle. And Porzingis missed another game, so a lot of weight on Doncic. And the Clippers, they were on a mission. They were on a mission last night. Leonard established himself early, aggressive from the get-go. You used to see that with Jordan. Like, if it was a game where they had to have it, he would just kind of take charge early and get off to a good start. Notably, a lot of other games in the playoffs, regular season, where Jordan would kind of try to facilitate, and if he had to take over in the fourth quarter, he took over. But when it came down to games where they really, really had to win or send a message, Jordan would take over early. Kawhi Leonard did that last night. That set the tone. And then Paul George was terrific last night. Very interesting comments from Paul George after the game. Listen to this. Very, very transparent. Giving you a little bit of a peek inside to what's happening in the bubble in Orlando. Here's Paul George about how he wasn't playing well and it has to do with the bubble.
Bubble got the best of me. I was just in a dark place. I really wasn't here. I checked out. So these past couple games, it was just difficult. But, you know, shout out the people that stood behind me, that was in my corner, the positivity, my teammates, my family, friends, everybody. Thank everybody that reached out to me. I was just in a bad place, and I found my way. I'm back, and I look forward to the rest of this run.
Paul George, 12 of 18 from the floor, 35 points, 4 of 8 from 3, 7 of 7 from the foul line. Clippers had a franchise playoff record for points, 154, and they made 22 three-pointers. That, too, is a franchise record, and they won by 43. Point differential, franchise record in the playoffs as well for the Clippers. Well, let's go back to what Paul George said, because I was watching this game live, and then what he said afterwards, I was mesmerized by what he said. I was like, wow, is he really honestly saying this? And we have talked about mental health before on this show. In fact, the editorial that I did with mental health and talking about heavyweight champion Tyson Fury, you know, that was something I submitted for the KAB. And that's a guy that's, you know, 6'9", 270, and he's got mental health issues, almost took his own life. Heavyweight champion of the world, you think, well, everything's going great. Kevin Love has come out and talked about it. DeMar DeRozan of the San Antonio Spurs has come out and talked about having mental health issues, depression, and so forth and so on. And everybody just automatically thinks that when people have money, they're automatically happy. And that is not true at all. You got a great wife and you got a great family. Your kids are good and your kids do well in school and you got a great job and so forth and so on, and you have no idea if those people are having a good time enjoying life or if they're miserable inside. And you just don't think about that when it comes to entertainers. Like, you know, we see it with comedians over the years. I mean, we saw Belushi, we saw Farley, and many others. You know, Robin Williams is one of the recent ones, of course, although it's been a little while. But those guys make you laugh. They're so full of life, and yet we didn't even know how miserable they were. You know,
yeah.
They put on a facade. They were really good at hiding it. And with NBA players, NFL players, it doesn't matter. Major League Baseball players, it doesn't matter the sport. It doesn't matter if it's WNBA. It doesn't matter if it's a men or women's sport. Everybody has issues with mental health, whether you have a really it could just be a day where you just had a bad day. That's mental health, man. You're stressed out. You're stressed out over COVID, or you're stressed out about you got a lot to do at work the next day and you can't sleep the night before. I've done that before. That's mental health. I mean, everything that happens in your life contributes either in a positive or negative way towards your mental health, whether you realize it or not. You know, Paul George is a guy that is getting ripped by social media and people because he was playing so poorly in games 2, 3, and 4. And he says last night in front of millions of people that basically he was in a dark place. The bubble got the best of him. People supported him. And they came to his room and talked to him and so forth and so on. And now the first thing that some people will do is say, oh, woe is me. Paul George has all this money. Boo-hoo-hoo. Big deal. You know, wah. That's the insensitive people that are out there that apparently have everything going perfect in their lives, which we know is not true. But let's put this in perspective. We talked about some NBA players the first few days in the bubble complaining about the food at the hotel or their room, which was, you know, a lot better than anything you and I are going to stay in. And we talked about how that's really not smart. Jay Williams, analyst, he's on ESPN, you know, used to be a great point guard at Duke, played in the NBA, and he said, listen, that's tone deaf. You got to understand what's happening in this world. There are people unemployed, losing their jobs, businesses going under, and you're complaining about how the meals aren't quite up to snuff because you're spoiled, basically. And people don't accept that. They don't really appreciate that are out in the real world, you know. And so these players are in a bubble, and they are treated well. They get all the testing they need for COVID. They follow the protocols. They should stay healthy. They are probably safer there than anywhere else in the world in regards to avoiding COVID. They have good meals, although it might not be what they're used to. They have hotel rooms that are nice. But it's not home. See, Doc Rivers put it very well last night after the game. He said, you know, it's different. We're all in a bubble. We can't leave until the season's over. Mm-hmm. You can't leave. And so what happens during a regular NBA season? Let's just talk about Paul George, okay? Paul George, normally an NBA season, if you're in the playoffs, you would be gone for 3 or 4 days. You'd play a couple of games. Well, let's look at this series, Clippers-Mavericks. First two games would have been in L.A. He would have slept in his own bed. Mm-hmm. He would have seen his wife and his children. I assume he has children. I don't know for sure. But he would have been with family and friends. He could have hung out with them. That helps you decompress after a game, whether you won or lost, you know, in L.A. against the Mavericks. That would have been a regular playoff season, no bubble. And then you'd travel to Dallas. You'd play a couple games, be there for maybe 3 or 4 days, and then you would go back home. And you see your family and your loved ones and your friends, and then you'd play a few games at home. Now, I'm trying to remember, wasn't it like late July when they went back to the bubble? The players went to the bubble?
Yeah, July 30th, I think is when. They went probably mid-July to the bubble.
I think it was like the 20th or 25th.
The game started on the 30th.
So let's just say it's about a month. So for 30 days, you know, I've heard people already complain about quarantine, that it drives them nuts for 10 or 14 days to be quarantined, even if they do or do not have COVID-19. Which, I think that would drive you a little bit stir-crazy. Now imagine being in a bubble for 30 days, and you're sitting here right away. I can hear some people already thinking, oh, come on, Wade. They're in nice hotels. They're in Disney World, Wild Sports, whatever. Yeah, but no family's there. And they see the same teams and players all the time. Mm-hmm. Guys they just played against, they're probably sick of seeing in a series, especially if they just beat you. Like, if you saw Luka, were you going to really be tickled to death seeing Luka at the swimming pool after what he did to you?
No.
And so all you have to lean on, I mean, you can call your wife, you can call your family and friends, but that's not the same as being able to give them a hug or hanging out with them, right?
Not at all.
And it's not the same, you know, in a hotel room, no matter how nice it is, isn't the same as being in your own bed at home. It just isn't. I mean, I've stayed at resorts out of the country, nice resorts, nice beds, but when I get home, I'm like, hey, nothing feels as good as my bed. And so you can understand when Paul George, game one, played pretty well. Game two, he struggles. And now all of a sudden, you don't have people to lean on other than your own teammates and your coaching staff who are close to you, don't get me wrong. But that's not the same as your mom or your dad or your sister or your wife or your brother or your kids. And so I understand, even though he's in a bubble, and I know Paul George is making lots of money, money doesn't buy him out of the bubble, does it?
No.
I mean, he can opt out. He could have opted out. He can't really now.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he could. He could check out. But he just said, I kind of checked out. Now, for him to be honest and say he checked out, some people take that as, wow, he really let his teammates down. He's being selfish. No, what he's saying is that he was in a dark place. He just didn't have the right mindset to play. Kevin Love's talked about this before. DeMar DeRozan has talked about this before. And athletes, especially on the male side, and men in general in society, and it's not just an athletic thing, it isn't necessarily just a male thing, but men are typically a lot less likely to tell you and say, I have a problem. Women are more likely to say they have a problem. That doesn't mean all women do that. There are many women that, just like men, will not let on as to what's going on in their life or put on a pretty face and smile, and you think everything's great, and they're torn up inside. It happens to all ages. It happens to men and women. However, men are more known to bottle it up. I know in my own family that's how it works. That's how I grew up. My grandpa had just passed away at the age of 99. Stubborn, bottled up, and I don't know if he ever told my dad he loved him. All right. Mm-hmm. My dad is 72. We're going to be 72. And he doesn't say that to me hardly at all. I don't know if I'm trying to remember if he has. He probably has. I just don't remember it. It sounds weird. I try to tell my kids every night before they go to bed, I say, hey, I love you. Even my teenage son now, who probably is kind of like, I love you too. That's kind of how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I always think, almost always, every day when I leave for work, or before they go to bed the night before, I try to think, you know, I see the stories when bad things happen to other families, whether something happens to your wife or your mom or your own kids, you know, if there's an accident, you know, my kid's now starting to drive, things like that. And I think, I don't want that last day. If there is that last day, and God forbid, I pray to God, I go before any of my children and my wife and everybody else. I hope I'm the first one to go, because I, not because I'm being selfish, I don't want to deal with the grief and the pain, but you, parents should never bury their children.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I look at it. The parents should never bury their children. And that happens a lot more than you realize. And so I always feel like I want to make sure if something ever does, God forbid, happen, that the last time I saw them or the last night before going to bed, I didn't fail to tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
So I am part of a family that has gone from my grandpa doesn't say those words, my dad doesn't really say those words, to where I'm kind of changing things in my family on the male side. Am I still stubborn? Do I still withhold my feelings? Do I, you know, say everything's fine when it's not? Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there times where I'm really down in my life? Have there been times? Absolutely. And I think anybody out there listening to this show, if you've never had a downtime in your life where you've been down, then congratulations, because you got to be an extreme minority of people. We've all had our ups and our downs. We just hope those downs are outweighed by all the ups. So when you look at Paul George, a guy making tons of money, who's on a great basketball team, chance to win a championship, and then playing the game he loves, and he talks about being in a dark place, and he kind of basically checked out, and the bubble got the best of him. Before you comment on social media and be insensitive and a jack-o'-lantern, maybe you should just stop for a second and go, how would I handle being in a place for at least 1 month, and it might be 2 months for the Clippers, without seeing my family, without giving them hugs? They're in L.A., I'm in Orlando. That's completely across the country. You need to stop and think before you shoot your mouth off in regards to, oh, these spoiled guys, boo-hoo-hoo, they got all this money. Listen, I know people don't have a lot of money. They're happier than people that do have a lot of money. I know a person, I've said this before, I know a person in my life that makes well north of $150,000. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
He's single. He's in his 40s. He has no children. He has no wife. He has no girlfriend. And I know he's not happy. Yet people will think, well, I'm only making $25,000. I want to be that person. It's not always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
So keep in mind, even though these are entertainers, actors, actresses, athletes, just remember they are human beings as well. They are people. And they go through the mental highs and lows just like anybody else. And in some cases, you can say they're a lot better off. They've got access to psychiatrists or counselors or mental health professionals. That's true. But if they don't ask for help, that don't matter.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, though, they're also much more highly scrutinized. I can go around, and I'm not making millions of dollars, but Dusty, I can go around, and I'm not going to be scrutinized for everything that I say on the radio. I'm sure I get scrutinized for something. That happens. But I'm not going to be picked apart and replay and watch or listen people do to every single word I say and go, oh, he misspoke there. He said A instead of the, or he mispronounced that name. Whereas when Paul George goes out, he can have a great game. If he misses a free throw, he's going to be vilified. You know, he throws the ball away. He could be 15 for 15 from the floor, 40 points, 10 assists, 10 rebounds, 10 steals. He could have no turnovers, and the last play of the game, they're down one, and he drops the basketball out of bounds, and he'll be vilified for it by some jack-o'-lanterns on social media, and people don't even know him. No matter how much money you make, if you're human and you see and you hear that stuff, you can't pay to have that go away. That comes with the job, and they know that, and they get perks of the job, the money, the mansions or whatever they have, the planes, whatever. But they're still human, and they still have mental health issues they have to deal with. And so when I hear Paul George say that last night, I feel for him. And yes, does it seem like he has things better than a lot of people in society? Yeah, it appears. It appears that way. And I'm glad that he had a good game last night. I'm glad that maybe he's out of that dark place. And I'm guessing there's other players that have had to deal with that as well. When you are in a place where you can't leave, or you're not leaving for at least 30 to 60 days, and that's what it could be for the Clippers. And now imagine, if you've already been in quarantine, ladies and gentlemen, for 10 or 14 days, you should be able to relate to what Paul George is talking about.
Absolutely. When you think about things like that with like high-profile athletes, entertainers, who, you know, musicians, whoever they are, that might deal with some of these problems, and you're like, well, I don't have any sympathy for them because they're making all this. But so let me give you an example here. There's a difference between sympathy and empathy.
Yes.
So maybe you don't. Maybe you're that guy, like you said, that's making 25 grand. This guy's making 150 grand, 250 grand a year. But and you're like, well, I'm worse off than them in this aspect of life. They're better off than me. And you don't have to sympathize with everybody in this world. But when you hear about people that have these kind of mental health issues, and it takes nothing to sit there and listen. It takes nothing to sit there and not judge people. Just be empathetic. Have empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, understand that they're in a tough situation, no matter what their life situation looks like from the outside. Understand that there's a lot of people that wrestle with demons inside, and we know about hardly any of them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, they're not going to let that on. They're not going to bring it out and say things like Paul George does. It's starting to become more of a popular thing to do. Not, I want to say popular,
well, not popular,
but more of a
acceptable,
trendy or acceptable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like you said, with some of the other guys that are doing it. And I think that once you get to that point, it's easier for those individuals to deal with those kind of issues and demons that they're wrestling with inside. Like you said, you've been down. I've been down. I've obviously been very depressed at times in my life. And when you're sitting in a hospital bed, you're depressed. When you're having financial problems, maybe you're depressed and things go, and we're all going to react different to that. Mm-hmm. And so I've never been, thankfully, to the point where probably even Paul George got. But you know, it helped me to have a support system that understood where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to help you too. So I don't ever try to trivialize anybody's mental thoughts about what's going on in their mind, because I don't know them. I'm not in their mind. Nobody is except them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't ever try to criticize any. I don't get on social media and be like, oh, Paul George is, he's just a baby. He's just going through all these things, and he's got it so much better than all of us. He should just man up, basically, is what some people will say. Mm-hmm. And I'm not one of those people. I'll never be one of those people, because I can't get into your mind. You can't get into my mind and understand what's actually going on that I'm wrestling with inside. It's just not possible. So have a little empathy for those people and understand that they're human like everybody else.
Yeah, and it can happen to you if it hasn't already. Once again, Paul George saying, I underestimated mental health. Honestly, I had anxiety, a little bit of depression, just being locked in here. I just wasn't there. I checked out games 2, 3, and 4. I wasn't there. Shout out to the people that were in my corner that gave me my words. They helped big time, helped me get right, get me back in great spirits. I can't thank them enough. And that's what you need, a support system. And that's the problem for people that haven't got the help soon enough. Either they didn't have the support system, or they did, but they never allowed that support system to support them. And then, you know, the worst thing happens,
too,
you know,
sure.
Unfortunately. Yep. So it's a good thing that people noticed some things with Paul George, or he reached out and they took care of him. And that's what your teammates should do. And that's why sports is more than sports. You are a family, whether you're a family that is dysfunctional and you have problems on your team, cancers, this and that, like Earl Thomas for the Ravens, who's no longer a Raven. But that's true of society. Like, a team is really a microcosm of a family and society when you think about it. You get along, and the more you get along, the more chemistry you have, and the more you can accomplish. And the more you argue and you fight and you disagree, the less likely you're going to get along very well. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And so sports is a microcosm of life.
Absolutely. It's everything you do is a microcosm,
yes,
of life, because it's life.
Absolutely.
It doesn't
sports
matter.
Sports is part of life.
What,
yeah,
you're in, what you're doing, these issues are going to come up with everybody. We're, like I said, it's a human issue.
It is. It's a human issue. No doubt. And I don't want to get too much into this, but since we're talking about a human issue, I saw Jacob Blake's sister. She's 30 years old. Very interesting speech she gave yesterday about how she hasn't even cried because she's just, you know, she's numb to everything now. And if you don't know the situation, Jacob Blake, her brother, 29, was shot from behind 7 times, and his kids were in the car. Now, there's all other details coming out. And I saw something on Twitter from a person who happens to be white. And I'm not saying that I'm sure there's somebody that's black that has probably said the same thing. But what I saw was a person, and I replied to it, and then I deleted my reply because I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to get drug into this because I know I'm not going to change this person's mind. But basically what the person was saying is, well, if the guy would have listened to the police and just done what they told him to do, I'm not justifying that they shoot him seven times. But you said but. You said but. When you say but, you negate what you just said. And so I put out there, I said, would you say the same thing if that were your son? Well, had my son just listened to the police more, he wouldn't be in the hospital paralyzed right now. Do you think he would say that if it were his son?
Doubtful.
Very doubtful.
Yeah.
Very doubtful. And so every person on this earth is a human being. They are human, whether they're making tons of money, whether they're extremely poor. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the skin or the color. It doesn't matter whether they have mental health issues or not. It doesn't matter if they're rich, they're poor, as I said, if you're privileged and not privileged. Every single person on earth that has a heartbeat, all right, is a human being, and they should be treated that way. And so when I see people say, well, if you just would have obeyed the police, that wouldn't have happened. Well, had the police not shot their guns, that wouldn't have happened. And I'm not one that's going to get on this cops are bad thing, because there are bad cops. There's also bad radio people. There's bad bankers. There's bad grocery store managers. I mean, I can go on. Any industry, there are bad apples. We've got a lot. We have, I think, many, many terrific men and women that are in law enforcement. Many. And when I see things being saying, well, if that guy would have done things differently, he wouldn't have got shot. Ernie Johnson on TNT last night, I thought, had the best line. He's white, and he has Shaquille O'Neal, Kenny Smith, and Charles Barkley, black, around him at that studio. And he said that what stood out to him was this, and it was simple and to the point. And Ernie Johnson said, it worries me when your last resort becomes your best option. Let that sink in. Your last resort becomes your best option. What he's saying is, the very last resort should be have to shoot a man seven times. That should not be the first option, shouldn't be the second option. It should be absolutely that is the, I mean, there is no, you got to use up all other options, and that is your very last choice to use is deadly force. He's right. Now, the question is, of the more details that come out of this case in Wisconsin with Jacob Blake, who's right now paralyzed, hopefully he'll regain his feeling extremities and walk again and everything will be okay with him physically, but who knows. And the other thing that's really sad about the story is his kids were in the car when this happened, which those officers are extremely lucky those kids weren't shot and killed. Can you imagine the uproar they'd have now today beyond what already is happening? And I bring this up not because I really wanted to talk about this today, but we're talking about mental health. We're talking about human beings, treating everybody human. And when somebody puts on Twitter, a guy that I ended up responding to and then deleted because I just didn't want to get into it anymore. When a guy says, well, if that guy would have done that, he wouldn't have got shot seven times in the back, leaning into his car. So you're saying it's okay. You're saying it's okay. But if that were your son or anybody you loved, would you put that on social media? It is inhumane to say things like that, in my opinion. If you want to say, hey, that escalated, so forth and so on, and you want to say both sides could have handled it better, sure, totally. I think it is, if you disobey the cops or the cops ask you to put your hands over your head and you resist, are you enhancing your chances of something to happen to you? Yes, you are. All right? But are you asking to be shot seven times?
No.
So that's the problem I have with all of this is when people get into the situation, and this is the way our country rolls, and they want to make something political, they don't even take the time to stop and think, what if that were my child? What if that were my child that was a police officer, made a horrible, tragic mistake and fired their gun? Or you want to defend that officer. And here's the problem I have. Not all officers are bad. And I thought Charles Barkley made a great point last night. He goes, you know, this is me thinking, but if you're a good cop, a really good cop out there, your reputation is being marred right now and smeared because of these bad incidences.
Mm-hmm.
There are many more positive incidences happening with law enforcement than there are bad ones. But these are ones that are magnified. Of this magnitude, it's huge. You know, it's the same thing with COVID we've talked about. We hear about the 6 cases, but we don't talk about the 57,994 that were negative. The minority almost always rules the majority when it comes to those type of discussions, correct? Mm-hmm. So when you're looking into this situation, why can't we, instead of right away saying the cops were right, the cops were wrong, the guy was wrong, the guy shouldn't have done what he did, he should have obeyed the officer. If he would have just obeyed the officer, nothing would have happened to them. Listen, I saw a family in Colorado that did nothing wrong. The cops got the wrong car, misidentified, and had the mom and all the kids handcuffed and their face and their stomach on the asphalt in 90 to 100 degree temperatures, and the kids were crying. And it was misidentification by the officers. Did they ask for that?
No.
So that's not okay, is it? And would that have happened to a white family? And I think a lot of people would say, probably not. Now, we don't know for sure, because that was a black family. But when you sit here and say, well, if you would have obeyed, that would have never escalated to that point. Well, there are people that haven't done anything wrong in this country, did everything that it said, and still bad things have happened to them, whether it is dealing with law enforcement or just bad things in life in general. They haven't asked for anything. They didn't do anything wrong. It happened. So I just want people to be a little more humane. I mean, when a guy on Twitter says that, you have no empathy whatsoever for somebody that nearly died. And the kids are going to have that traumatic experience for the rest of their life. And on top of that, the cops, I would hope some of them involved in an incident are feeling bad, too.
Yes.
I would think they are. I would hope to God they are. Because the last thing you should want to do as an officer is fire your gun. That should be the last resort, as Ernie Johnson said. Now, maybe they had reason to do what they did. The truth hopefully will come out. We don't know all the specific details. But to say, well, if he would have just obeyed the officer, none of that would have happened. You can't say that. I mean, you can, but we've seen instances where people do what they're told, and still things have happened. So when you throw that out immediately after this has happened, you come across as, one, inhumane, two, you have no heart, three, you have no feelings. But if that happened to your loved one, whether they're white, black, Asian, Puerto Rican, Indian, I don't care. If that happened to somebody you loved, it could be a friend. It don't have to be a relative. It don't have to be blood. If that happened, would you be saying that? Well, you know, it's his fault he got shot 7 times while leaning into a car. Now, maybe he was reaching for a gun, and that's why it was self-defense. Maybe he was going to grab a knife. There are also kids in the car. Did the officers even see the kids in the car? Don't you think you probably shouldn't be firing if there's kids in the car? According to the story I'm reading, the kids were in the car. Okay, I don't know all the details. All I'm saying is, on the cover, it doesn't look good, does it? It seems to be,
none of these things do.
It seems to be extreme what happened. And unfortunately, but like getting back to Charles Barkley's point, I thought was interesting. He said, listen, there's a lot of great cops out there. If you're a cop out there and you are a really good cop, don't you get tired of other cops doing bad things to where you would eventually want to basically get them out of the force?
Yes.
You would hope so. The question, though, is there the police unions? Is it the power at the top not allowing people to speak up to get the bad apples out of the bunch, to where people have tried to rat out the bad apples? And when they've tried, they've lost their jobs, or who knows what else has happened to them? Is it all about intimidation, to where even people within the force that try to do the right thing and say, hey, listen, this guy's doing the wrong things. You know, I'm with him and he's using force. He's breaking the rules and the laws he's supposed to uphold. And the chief of police, or, you know, whoever it may be, the higher ranking officials basically blow you off. What do you do? Do you reach out to the media? Do you go that far? I understand what Barkley's trying to say. I really do. You would, because this isn't if you're a really good cop, especially if you're in Wisconsin right now, in Kenosha, Wisconsin right now, or of course in Minnesota, if you're a really good cop, you're darned if you do, darned if you don't right now, because you're getting labeled all cops are bad, or you really want to get the bad apples out of the bunch, but you might not be able to do it, even if you really try.
Yeah.
It is a really tough spot for them to be in, too. And so there is no perfect solution. There is no great one answer. But it goes back to the golden rule. It goes back to being humane, as you said, I think, earlier. Empathy. And understanding the plight of others. And for people on social media who have absolutely no heart and don't stop for one freaking second to think, hey, innocent until proven guilty. That includes law enforcement too, by the way. Okay, in fairness, that should be allowed for everybody. Innocent until proven guilty. Let's collect all the facts that we can and know what really happened. So let's not try to rush the judgment too quickly. At the same time, why can't we stop, regardless of skin color, and say to ourselves, what would I do if that were my son or my daughter involved in that situation? From both sides, as a police officer and as Jacob Blake. Does that make sense what I'm saying? I'm trying to present two ways of looking at this from different perspectives. We know the perspective of the victim, no question. Although some people don't want to understand it, and they make it political. But we also need to understand that officers, I mean, can you imagine this? I've thought about this before. And we know there have been instances where this has actually happened. You're already on edge as an officer. If you're dealing with a lot of crime in the area or whatever else, you're already on edge. You might not be getting a lot of sleep. You might have had a bad day. You might have a bad mental health day. And you might do something you really shouldn't do when you have a gun, okay? That's scary, no question. You hope that doesn't be taken out on other innocent people. You really hope that's not part of this equation. Maybe it is. But at some point, we all have responsibilities. And I really do believe that you have to look at an officer in a situation where if he is out doing his thing and a young kid comes out with what looks to be a real gun and points it right at you, you either wait, hoping that's not a real gun, and maybe it's not, everything's great. You tell the kid, hey man, you can't be doing this. You can't be pointing this at an officer. This looks like a real gun. Or you don't do anything and the kid shoots and kills you or hurts you. Or the worst case of all probably is you fire as an officer, you kill a kid, and then find out it was a toy gun. You have a split second to make a decision as an officer in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was a split second decision that happened with Jacob Blake. Does all split second decisions, are they all wrong? Are they all right? Some are right, some are wrong. We sometimes have to make split decisions when you're driving a car. There's a car coming over the center line. Are you going to swerve and lose control and go into the ditch? Or do you just say, listen, I'm going to try to get over, or there's a deer. Are you going to swerve and roll your car? Or are you going to just take out the deer because that's the lesser of two evils? Mm-hmm. You have a split second decision. You don't have time to go through all the scenarios. You can train for this all you want as a law enforcement officer. Until you're under that situation, you don't know exactly how you're going to handle it. Hopefully you're prepared when it comes to training. And you got to deal with a whole bunch of different personalities and people, how they're going to handle authority. So what I'm trying to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, is please have empathy for as many people involved as you can. Does that make sense? Try to understand the jobs that law enforcement has and that they do have to make split-second decisions. And that one split-second decision can take a life, and it can be the wrong thing to do. It could be the right thing to do. And then there are those few bad apples out there that totally know what's wrong and right and do it anyway. And that, those apples are the ones that are making it tough for the rest of the good people out there. And that's what I think is unfortunate. I know people in law enforcement. I have friends in law enforcement. I know Dusty does as well.
A lot of family.
A lot of family in law enforcement. I appreciate what they do. I thank them for what they do. And there's a reason why I didn't choose to get in that profession, because I probably couldn't handle all of that.
Absolutely.
The things, the things that officers may see. You go into a homicide situation or there's a murder investigation. I mean, the things you see, you will not be able to unsee for the rest of your life. So I really feel that we all get so blinded by what becomes political and we lose track of the very thing we talked about with Paul George at the beginning of this discussion. We lose track that every single person is human. Every single person may have a bad day. Every single person is going to make a bad decision. You just pray to God it isn't a bad decision that takes someone's life. Whether it's a bad decision, drinking too much and getting behind the wheel and running somebody over. Whether it's being an officer with a gun and making a wrong decision to pull the trigger. Or a person who makes a wrong decision and fights police officers and then bad things happen when they should have maybe done what the officer asked them to do. There are, we always want to paint a nice clean brush, don't we, over everything. If we are, we want to say all cops are bad, or we want to say that all people that are involved in these situations like Jacob Blake didn't obey the police. They were asking for it, or that's what escalated it. So it really, that justifies the means. The ends justify the means. There is no one correct answer to any of that. But the problem in today's society is we all, not we all, many people out there think they have the right answer. And they will not listen to any other possibility. I'm right. To hell what you think. I'm right. All right? Cops are bad. Or, I'm right. That guy asked for it. They just wouldn't have resisted or didn't do this or didn't do that. It's not that simple. We talk about this situation. Black, in essence, versus white. And it's never that clear. It's gray. It always is. It always will be. But for those that want to make it, it's this. It's black and white. It's very simple. It's black and white. You're either with the side or you're against the side. No. Pretty much everything in society is fairly gray. But some of us can't accept that.
No.
We want answers, and we demand answers, and we deserve answers in many different situations, no question about it. And so, once again, I go back to where we started with, mental health. A police officer may be having a bad day. We don't know what happens in their life behind the scenes. The victim or even a criminal. We don't know what's happening in their life and why they went and shoplifted or why they did this or that. And I'm not trying to say I condone people doing any of the bad things. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, trying to understand where people are coming from. How were they raised? Even people that have done horrible, unspeakable things like school shootings, okay? If we go back and look at the background of the person that did whatever they did, maybe we can help understand and prevent that in the future by perhaps people getting the mental health help they need. And that's what Paul George got. He needed some help. He got it from his teammates. He had a support system. Do law enforcement, do they have a great support system in regards to the things they see every day and the things they have to do and the decisions they have to make? You know, do people that don't have a job, but they want to get a job and they're working and they got to live on the streets or they got to just live from paycheck to paycheck? You know, are people trying, do they have people they can reach out to and help them in a time of need? Because we all need support. We all need help at some point or another in our lives. But yet, when it comes to situations like this, we completely ignore all of that. This person's bad. That person's good. That person's a victim. Those people are horrible. And we never stop to think what people are truly going through from both sides of the discussion. And I think that's extremely unfortunate.
I don't have much to add to that. It's I agree with pretty much everything there. I mean, we're all there's no way that just to kind of briefly talk about it, there's no way we can understand. I'm in Glen Elder, Kansas, right? So I looked this up. 743 miles away from Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I see a 1 minute and 15 second video or whatever it is from Kenosha, Wisconsin, which basically only shows me the guy getting up, walking to his vehicle, opening the door, and the cop shooting seven times at him. I have no precursor to this. I have no what happened after. What do the cops do after? That's it. It stops after pretty much after the bullets go through.
Right.
How do I know what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin by watching a minute and 15 second video? You can get all these accounts from other people that say, this is what happened before. How do you know that? Like, where did you get your information?
Right. Were you a witness?
Were you there? And so that's what I think, that's probably the biggest problem with the social media videos that we see. Now, when it's George Floyd and it's 8 minutes, we saw a lot there, okay?
Yeah.
But when you see some of these other things, we don't see everything that happens. So how am I going to make a judgment of what happened on something I never saw, something I was not a party to, something I'm getting five different sources of info from that are probably not even all saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying different things because they're trying to make it political. They're trying to say, this is why this happened.
Push an engine,
this happened here. One side's going to say this. The other side's going to say this. I wasn't there. I didn't see it happen. I wasn't part of it. I'm not going to make a decision on this thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As far as right, wrong, otherwise, it seems wrong when you see a cop shoot seven times into a vehicle. But I don't know what happened. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he was reaching for. You can't see that. I don't know what happened here. I don't know what happened here. And I'm not making judgments. I'm just saying.
Maybe they thought he was reaching for a gun, and one cop fired, and the other six reacted.
Yeah, and
I don't know.
And you know, you just don't know what happened. And for me, I'm not going to justify or not justify what the cop did. I'm not going to justify or not justify what Jacob Blake did. Cause I don't know what's going on. I wasn't there, and we get into this so much of. There's so much social media we don't think for ourselves.
Exactly. Thank you.
And so it's like, this is what this person said. Oh yeah, they got to know they got to know what they're talking about. They're right about that. So we piggyback on what everybody else is saying. Like I get tired of when I'm going to go off on a little bit. I get tired like when I'm scrolling through Facebook and all I see is people sharing stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I have no original thoughts of what they're putting on there. And it's not just Facebook, it's Twitter too. And I'm not saying everybody's
and odds
like
are they
that.
Didn't read the stuff they're sharing in full.
And you know, I don't mind the people that share like the memes and funny jokes and stuff like that. But a lot of this other stuff is just nothing original. No original thoughts. They're just sharing what somebody else said. And there's nothing in their thought process of I thought this out before I shared it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just with so much stuff, and it's like, yeah, like I say, I retweet mostly funny stuff, you know, things I think that are whimsical sometimes. But if there's a real issue, like a social justice issue, like any kind of political issue, first of all, I usually stay away from it. But second of all, I'm gonna have a thought provoking post about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm gonna think it out myself, and I'm gonna make you read this. And try to think for yourself, too, and try to understand where somebody else is coming from. And we just don't do that. We just listen to what everybody else is saying and make our assessments based on that. Mm-hmm. Like, if people ever saw my hydroxychloroquine post, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a very long post about why it benefits me. Mm-hmm. And people are going to get on there. I said, I don't want discussion. I don't do this for argument. Mm-hmm. I know these are facts of what's happened to me.
Right.
And I can say what's happened to me. Mm-hmm. Then I get replies that are saying, oh, that's not even part of it anymore. It absolutely is, because I go to the
and they've
eye
not been in your shoes
every
and done
6 months to make sure my eyes are okay being on that medication. Yeah. Obviously, I'm not doing that just because it's not a thing anymore.
Right.
And that's just what I'm talking about. People just start throwing stuff out, and they don't think about it. It's not thought-provoking. It's not anything. It's just, this is what this person believes. Oh, yeah, I think that's right. I believe that, too. I'll just
piggyback on that. Yeah, not even read the article.
Not even give any comments, but just share it.
I'll read the headline, because that's easy. I need more time to go post elsewhere, so I can just read the headline, not the story that I'm sharing, and don't even know what's in the story. That happens a lot. So anyway, sorry to get on the soapbox, ladies and gentlemen, but I think
I think
it applies to everything. Like I said, it ties back to Paul George with mental health, and that's how I got over to that, and I wasn't planning on going on. But I'm telling you, there's a mental health aspect to all of this, every single thing. I mean, it is for the officers involved in this, for Jacob Blake, clearly, and for his kids, and for his family, and for their communities, and for all of law enforcement in Kenosha, even the cops that weren't there, obviously. There's a mental health aspect of this now, because you know they're under fire, not hopefully literally, but they're doing investigations. We've seen this so many different times. It's kind of like it's on repeat, you know, the button on your repeat music, you know, hit the button and repeat or shuffle, and we want answers, and we should get answers. We hope to get answers. And all I'm trying to tell people right now, to summarize, if you're just tuning in, is try to understand, try to put yourself in the shoes of when you just brush off somebody being shot that many times and just say, well, you know, that person, that he didn't do what the officer asked him to do. Not that condones anybody shooting the guy, but when you say but, you just erase what you just said, and have no empathy for a person that was shot and now paralyzed. And you don't even consider that, what if that were your kid? Would you say the same thing? No, you wouldn't. I guarantee you wouldn't. Okay, on the flip side of that, you know, if you're an officer and you thought you were in harm's way and that he was reaching for a gun or a weapon of some kind, and you react, once again, there's that split-second decision that I just talked about that can change your life and many others' people's lives. And it doesn't pertain just to law enforcement or just to the Jacob Blake case. It applies to whether you're driving down the road and a deer jumps in front. You make a split-second decision. You can practice all you want about hitting the brakes, and you don't know which way the deer is going to go. And this may sound still silly to you. You're like, oh, come on, wait. You're talking about hit and run with a deer, comparing it to what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Yeah, I am, from this standpoint. We all make split-second decisions. And sometimes they're the right decisions. Sometimes they can be really bad decisions. We all regret doing things. I think Jacob Blake, maybe if you talk to him, may say, you know what, I probably could have done things better to where that wouldn't have escalated. And I think if you talk to, hopefully, some of the cops involved, they would say, you know what, we could have done better to where it didn't get to that point, too. Both sides were wrong, and there was probably both contributed probably to that escalation. Mm-hmm. I think if everybody was actually honest in a room together with no cameras and no media around, I think they would all say, listen, we both could have done this better. And we let this get too far down the road. And then there was an explosion at the end in regards to the shooting. So we talk about Paul George and mental health. We all have issues. We hopefully have a support system. So I'm going to say this to close. I hope Jacob Blake and his family has a really good support system. And especially for his children, that I can't imagine what those kids are going through. Also, I hope that the officers involved, I hope that they have a support system to help them deal with this situation in regards to what caused them to open fire. And that I'm sure many of them are replaying this in their head over and over and constantly reminded with social media and watching TV about the decision or decisions that they made. And the bad thing, I mean, there's lots of bad things here, but once you make a decision, especially in law enforcement, and that's my big point in law enforcement, once you make a decision with a weapon, same thing if you're a criminal, by the way, or anybody for that matter, once you make a decision with deadly force of any kind, whether it's punching somebody, whether it's stabbing somebody, whether it be a gun, a knife, a baseball bat, whatever it may be, once you've gone that far, even if it's a one-time bit of rage or you made a split-second decision that you eventually, you can look back and say, ah, that was a mistake. You can't take it back. You cannot take it back.
No.
You will never be able to take it back. You have to live with that for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life, whether you believe you did the right thing or the wrong thing, and the problem is if you think you've done the right thing and all these people telling you did the wrong thing, that makes it even more difficult. If you know you did the wrong thing and everybody tells you did the wrong thing, that doesn't make you feel any better. And if you believe you did the wrong thing and yet you're being hailed as a hero, that probably don't make you feel great either. So see how that goes, no matter how it is. There's issues to deal with, and I'm just going to pray for everybody involved in that incident in Wisconsin from both sides. And I know people maybe say, wait, just pick a side here. No. Listen, I already made my peace with it. If you at least have to have empathy, and if you don't have empathy, and if you don't understand, and don't think about this as what if that, if Jacob Blake was my son, or what if that the officer that fired first was my son. See, there's two different perspectives here to consider. And if you're not thinking about those things, then you're really not thinking it all the way through, or you're picking a side, which people tend to do. But when I see stuff on social media just basically poo-pooing what happened and forgetting that somebody was shot in front of their children, whether that was justified or not, that doesn't change the fact children were in the car. I mean, if that was, even let's assume it, let's just say it was all justified. Still doesn't change what they're going to deal with for the rest of their lives as children. No. Whether or not the cops did the right thing or the wrong thing, they're going to see that for the rest of their lives. And who knows what kind of problems will happen. And hopefully they have the support system they need. So you see how it's all a domino effect? Just remember, I really want to stress this. There are bad apples in every bunch. There are bad apples in every job out there, including radio and TV and media. There are. You just hope those bad apples are very far and few between, and you hope that you can weed out some of that. I don't know if the cops in Wisconsin are truly bad apples. I don't know, and I'm not going to say they are, because as Dusty just said, we have a minute and 15 second video. Why don't we go ahead and gather the information, and as we and instead of being a jury here in society automatically condemning everybody and everything, maybe we let it play out just a little bit, because that's what happens in the judicial and justice system, which people could say, you know, it's unjust. I get that. That's a whole other discussion for another day. But based on our system of democracy, all right, you are innocent till proven guilty. That's how it's supposed to be. You are judged by a jury of your peers, and you have a case. You hopefully have good representation. You may or may not get off if you're in a trial and something's against you or for you. But in society, we are so quick to convict no matter what side or what issue we are on. What side of the issue on, we're automatically quick to convict. Jacob Blake asked for it. You're already convicting the guy who got shot. The police are horrible. You're convicting the officers before you know the whole story. See? That's what we want to do. That's what we always do. We want to automatically, as Dusty said, 743 miles away in our own backyard here in North Central Kansas, we all, many of us, probably already have an opinion of who was right and who was wrong. And we haven't even gathered the information yet. For all of you that think a certain way, there might be some little bit of evidence that comes out of this thing that completely blows away your thinking. But the problem is, after a while, we're so stuck on that thinking that even when that pops up, we're not going to change our thinking. Yeah. And that is messed up.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.